22-0359, Vanderweil versus Walgren. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, and respondent will have 15 minutes in response, and then finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone in the center, tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, and you may begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Kuhl, and I represent appellant cross-respondent Sharna Walgren. The first issue before the court today is that husband violated his discovery and disclosure obligations by failing to provide financial statements through the date of trial, and the trial court then erred in holding that against wife in finding that she failed to meet her obligation to show a change in value in those accounts such that a different valuation date was warranted. And husband's obligation here was twofold. First, every party to a marital dissolution action has an affirmative obligation to disclose their assets. And that obligation continues throughout proceedings and until the decree is entered.
Ms. Kuhl, does that obligation extend to the value of assets, well, their value after the valuation date? It seems like the purpose of selecting a valuation date is so that issues are simplified. We can look at the financial statements as of that date, March of 2018, I think, in this case, without the need to do extensive discovery and additional fact-finding about later dates.
No, because...
No, there is no duty?
That was my original question.
Is there a duty to update or supplement discovery responses, even with respect to the value of assets after the valuation date?
Yes, there is a continuing duty after the valuation date, because in this case in particular, the trial court stated when it set the valuation date that it was allowing wife to argue for a different valuation date as to particular assets at trial, but then essentially denied her the very documents that she would have needed in order to do that. And so she needed to continue to get disclosures from husband to be able to show whether there was a change in the value of the accounts so that she could argue at trial for a different valuation date for those particular assets, which the trial court, again, said that she would have the right to do.
Did you move to compel discovery?
We did, yes. And the trial court found that his discovery responses were adequate, incorrectly concluding that he did not continue to have a disclosure and discovery obligations. And so that is why we ended up here challenging that as well. And this is important.
Was there any offer? What I'm trying to find out is, I mean, is it that you don't know what you don't know?
That's exactly the case. We don't know what we don't know. We don't know what happened to those accounts during the period of time where we don't have statements, and that's precisely the point. That we're not able to meet our burden because we don't have the statements.
So what argument would you like to have made? Or what, you know, based on your suspicions or expectations about changes in values, what would you have argued, do you think, if you had gotten more discovery?
Well, the standard for a different valuation date for particular assets is that if there's been a substantial change in value of a particular asset, such that the different valuation date would be fair and equitable for that particular asset, then the court can adopt a different valuation date for a particular asset. And so that's the argument we would have made, is that
With respect to which asset, by how much money?
Well, we don't know. That's
but what's your theory? What's your expectation? I mean, you know what the stock market has done. You know what the other assets were. I mean, what's your supposition?
We know that he continued to earn an income of about $200,000 a year and claimed to be living on a budget of $5,000 a month during this time period. So we assume that he was accumulating substantial assets during this time period. We have a right to know where they went and how much they continued to appreciate. And so wife would be arguing that during the time when they were still married, before the decree was entered, she has a right to some of a share of those assets. And I do want to direct the court's attention to the Supreme Court just decided a case last month called Pooley versus Pooley, 979 Northwest 2nd, 867, which, although the facts are different, it does reaffirm and reemphasize this affirmative obligation of the parties to disclose their marital assets, and explains that the reason that's so important is that the trial court's not able to make an equitable division of marital assets unless it has full information about what the assets actually are. And then
I assume, school, you're not arguing that he's hiding assets. You're just arguing that the valuation of the assets that have previously been disclosed might be more. Is that a fair statement, or am I not following?
In a sense, he's hiding assets because he's not being forthright in providing the financial statements that we've requested.
Right, but I mean, there's a difference between, you know, he's got $2 million buried in the backyard that nobody knows about versus, you know, the retirement accounts went up or down depending on what, you know, particular valuation date you chose. I mean, it's more the latter than the former. Would that be a fair statement?
I think that's accurate. It's true. There's no allegation that he's hiding or that burying money in the backyard.
And he did provide some updates, correct? I mean, after the valuation date.
So the record contains statements, particularly for the Fidelity account and the Novation account, up to February 2020, which is over 6 months before trial, and it's over a year before the judgment and decree. So there's still a substantial period of time where we don't know what happened to those accounts.
So we're talking about the 6 months before trial?
Correct,
yeah. Okay, I just want to make sure that I understood. Thank you.
Correct. And then separately, in addition to the affirmative obligation that all marital dissolution parties have, there's a separate duty under the discovery rules as well to supplement your responses. And this is all statements that wife requested during the discovery period. And therefore, when he received additional monthly statements, he was on notice that he had an obligation to supplement those responses.
I have a question about the HELOC. So she drew $200,000 down on that line of credit. Are those funds reflected on the asset statement where there's 172 plus 10 in two asset accounts?
So I believe the balance sheet does reflect on her column it's about $180,000 left in her accounts that she took from the home equity line of credit and then were in her accounts, correct?
So in a sense, I mean, she's getting both an asset and a liability. The only difference is, I think, $17,000 between what's shown in the two columns.
Well, the problem is that she's assigned the full liability to repay it.
Right, and was assigned the full, I mean, that's my question. Was she also assigned the full value of the money that she withdrew?
Well, but this money was used to pay daily living expenses that were found by the court to not be nefarious spending, and so that those expenses and the home equity line of credit, which was a marital debt, should have been divided equally between the parties.
So what is the evidence that the money was used, and when was it used? Because I think she drew down a matter of months before the valuation date, right?
She withdrew it, I believe, about 3 months before the trial court's assigned valuation date, and there was about $180,000 in her accounts from the home equity line of credit on the valuation date. But for the purposes of determining whether it's a marital debt, you look at the time that it's withdrawn, and that was before the valuation date.
I mean, I want to hear more about whether and how she used the funds. I mean, I think the evidence was that she was concerned about her liquidity, so she withdrew it to make sure she had enough cash on hand. But I'm not aware of the evidence that she actually needed it or actually used it. And in fact, months later, most of it was still in her bank account.
Well, she did need it because husband told her specifically not to use their joint accounts. And even during the time period where she was employed with the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, she was earning an income around $100,000. That's less than what the trial court found to be her reasonable monthly expenses. So at husband's direction, she used the home equity line of credit to cover sort of that gap between what her income was and her reasonable monthly expenses.
I understand the logic of that, but is there actually evidence in the record of transfers out of that account, you know, toward expenditures or either directly or indirectly?
There are statements from the accounts in the record.
So if I could follow up on Judge Johnson's questions about the home equity line. Looking at paragraph 61 of the district court's findings, the district court seems to me, it's not like it just said, oh, instead, you know, made a straightforward argument from your perspective, you know, error, that these are marital funds and they should have been, or as opposed to non-marital funds. So the district court talks about the fact that your client withdrew the accounts, you know, on the originally scheduled, you know, case management conference, put them in her name, didn't tell anyone. There seems to be, the district court seems to cause the district court a lot of concern looking at this finding that your client was trying to hide this money and that went in, that somehow that the district court factored that in. Is that a fair reading of that? And does the district court have the discretion to do just what it did?
Well, the key finding that the trial court goes on right under the part where you're quoting is that it says there's nothing nefarious about her spending.
Can I just say, though, the district court also says out of those HELOC funds, she paid her attorney's fees, which are, as you know, regarding respondent, a non-marital expense, and that her American Express card shows excessive spending. So there's a lot in there.
It says that some of her spending was non-essential, but this is a high-income couple, and so non-essential does not mean it's not within the marital standard of living. They would have lots of spending, presumably, that some would consider non-essential. And so I think that what's interesting is that despite those statements that you've quoted, the trial court still says, you know, there's nothing nefarious about this.
Counsel, if you're correct, just for purpose of this question, and the district court should have said that these funds were a marital asset, but the district court was also correct that she used some of that marital asset to pay non-marital expenses, you know, given the scope of the dollars we're talking about here, is that, you know, a de minimis mistake?
Well, so husband did not make...
qualify my question one more? I'm sorry to interrupt you. If that's the only mistake.
So husband didn't actually make a finding of dissipation, and the trial court would have been required to find exactly how much would have been dissipation versus not dissipation if that's the way that it was going to go, and none of that occurred. The trial court didn't identify a particular amount found for attorney's fees or what have you. And so with that context, I think you can't make a finding that it was improper under that situation.
I have a question about your argument concerning dissipation by paying attorney fees. Does it matter that the fees were paid from a bank account after the valuation date and the bank account was later awarded to him? In other words, you know, wasn't that, in the end, you know, his asset anyway? And so what, you know, how is your client worse off by his using those funds to pay his attorney fees?
I believe there was some attorney fee payments before the valuation date. I think they continued after the valuation date. But their husband really hasn't disputed that he did use marital funds to pay attorney's fees. His argument in reply was that wife did too, which of course is an entirely separate issue, but I think we all agree that no marital funds should be used to pay attorney's fees.
Well, what if, but I guess given my, if it was after the valuation date and if it was from an account awarded to him, that's still an error?
If it was after the valuation date and from his non-marital funds, then if it was from non-marital funds, then that's different.
My understanding is it was from marital funds awarded to him.
So I think that would essentially be the same.
May I ask a question on that as well? Weren't the funds paid from a bank account that his ongoing monthly checks were being deposited by his employer into that account, you know, after the valuation date?
I believe so, yes.
So wouldn't that be a factor for us to look at as well?
So, I mean, was it a dollar deposited post-valuation date versus was it a dollar deposited pre-valuation date? I don't know how you can separate which dollar came in at which point. It's in the same account together. And so the argument is, you know, again, I think it's undisputed that some marital funds were used to pay attorney's fees and that's dissipation under clearly established law. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll now hear for counsel for respondent, please.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Linda DeBeer, and I represent Russ Vanderweel, and I have represented him since 2017. When we argue before this court, we always say, may we please this court. It may be rather difficult.
People rarely do.
In this case.
Present company excluded.
It doesn't come easy. We are handing you an appeal that is as tangled as a plate of spaghetti. I believe if we focus on the standard of review and the trial court's actions instead of what the parties want, that it will all become more straightforward. We may not get that pasta lined up in rows and back in the box, but at least it won't be such a mess. I'll start with the issues.
You know, I'm gonna stop you.
Okay.
Could we reset it at 15? I think we're kind of, I don't know what we're doing, but I think it's, just give us a second. These things are very, take your time. These things are very complicated and we haven't used them in 2 years, so I'm surprised I can find the courtroom.
Well, and I did. So the respondent has 15 minutes for both the cross appeal and the response,
yes,
is my understanding. Okay.
Right, you're limited. So just give us a second here.
Yeah.
Go right ahead. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I will start with a few of our larger issues. One of the first issues to present to this panel is the value of the Utah condo. The trial court found that it was valued at $1.25 million. We understand this is an uphill battle to succeed with overturning a trial court's finding of fact. We have to show that it's clearly erroneous. There is no support for that number in the trial record. To summarize the evidence that was before the court, it found that value based upon respondents' parenting financial disclosure statement, which was filed in March of 2018. This is a statement that is required for hearings throughout the process. It's notable that appellant did not file any statement for that hearing.
And let me skip ahead. So did he testify that that was a typographical error? The judge's order does not indicate that he disavowed the number.
Yeah, he did. And I think that's one of the more difficult points, too, is actually that the judge's final decree states that he did, it states specifically, husband failed to testify as to the difference in values from the appraisal in 2017 to what he put in his pleadings 4 months later, stating that the value is based upon appraisal. That's the court's finding of fact. But the court seems to have forgotten or missed husband's testimony that in fact he did testify. At trial, his cross-examination revealed that he believed his PFDS, that's the statement, was accurate at the time of signing, but he derived the number from the actual appraisal. And he also testified he wasn't certain whether he'd been able to review the appraisal when he filled out that PFDS.
Was there other evidence of a value that was much greater than that?
Like absolutely.
1.9, I'm thinking about some evidence in the record that was 1.9.
Oh, I do not recall evidence of the value being at 1.9. It's interesting to note, just as the trial court indicated in its decree, that the husband actually waffled whether he wanted this property. He was willing for it to be sold. He was willing for it to be awarded to wife. He was not exactly excited about having it awarded to him. The evidence in the record about its value is husband's testimony, the appraiser's testimony and her appraisal. The actual appraisal that the PFDS statement refers to did come in with the expert testimony. This isn't a situation where there's a range of values. It is acceptable for trial courts to pick a value within a range of values. That's from the case of Hertz. But here, the evidence is all derived from that appraisal. Even the wife herself testified that on the date of valuation, she believed the value to be that of husband's appraisal.
But counsel, if I may, wasn't there a property tax assessment that was, I think, just a little under $1 million? Then you've got this appraisal listed at $1.9 million. So it seems to me what the district court's number is in between. Doesn't that provide us with the range you just talked about?
No, I don't. The appraisal was actually $1.199 was the appraised value. And husband's, you know, been willing to round that up to $1.2. But I am not familiar with any fact that says it was worth $1.9 million, just $1.199. So we see this as a case where the only evidence before the court is the appraisal, the husband's reference to the appraisal, even the wife's reference to the appraisal, and the value of $1.25 million originates from an inaccuracy in the husband's PFDS statement, but even that statement says it's based upon the appraisal. So we basically have
Understand that argument, counsel. I'm going to skip to another issue, if
sure.
I may.
Yes.
And that is the life insurance issue. Is there evidence in the record of the amount of that policy?
I do not know off the top of my head, Your Honor. It would have been life insurance available through employment.
Mm-hmm.
So I would guess that there is some type of value, but I don't recall it off the top of my head.
Okay.
And it is certainly within the trial court's discretion to order it. We just believe that it should be commensurate with whatever amount of maintenance is ordered. So, for example, in the final year of maintenance, he should not be required to have...
That's why I'm curious about the amount of the policy.
Yes. I apologize, Your Honor, that do not know that off the top of my head. After the...
Can I ask now about the medical bills?
Yeah.
Your opposing counsel argues that... I think you argue they should be paid or shared debt only if they were presented. I think the responsive argument is they were presented. Seems like an evidentiary matter. I mean, is there a conflict in the evidence on that point, or...
Your Honor, we believe that this is now a de minimis issue because if the court maintains the date of valuation, the medical bills at issue are after the date of valuation. So as long as the date of valuation remains constant, it won't be an issue. And even if
it changes...
In that case,
you would abandon the argument if...
Well, it's a de minimis. It is de minimis.
Yeah, but we don't reverse for de minimis amounts, right? So, I mean, is that... I'd like to be clear about whether you're still asking the court to reverse on that issue or not.
If the date of valuation remains constant, it does not need to be reversed.
Okay.
And if the date of valuation changes, it's de minimis. It is important to note that the husband continued to make his income available to her and deposited into a joint account. So if they were paid after the date of valuation, he doesn't want to pay them twice. But in light of the magnitude of the other issues, It really is de minimis. Perhaps one of the largest issues is that the trial court found that wife's budget should include $3,500 to be saved toward retirement. This error has two components to it. One is a clearly erroneous finding of fact by the court because the funds were put in an investment account, not a retirement account.
Does that matter? I mean, what type of account it is? If the purpose of the setting the money aside is for the future, for retirement, for financial security, does it really matter what type of account is used?
Well, I think both are incorrect, Your Honor, because they are accumulating assets after the date of valuation. I do think that there's more of a tradition of providing for retirement. Usually it's done through payroll deductions, but I would assert that whether it's an investment account or a retirement account, it's still inappropriate. It violates our statute about having a date of valuation and that assets accumulated after that date are the non-marital property of the person who accumulates or finds them. Here, there's also no finding of need whatsoever. These parties have ample retirement assets and ample assets, and there's nothing to indicate that wife is short on retirement assets. And also, I think, a very detailed look at the case law.
Yes. Today, but, you know, I don't think she's, I mean, she's not retiring at age 53. I mean, I assume she's, like most of us, are going to sort of keep working until Social Security. So, you know, that's a 10 years where who knows what's going to happen in terms of, you know, her post, you know, when the maintenance runs out, you know, whether, she, I mean, maybe she's going to get a job, maybe she's not, I don't know. And then also what's going to happen in terms of, you know, the valuation of the holdings 10 years from now, depending on what the market does, so.
Well, she did retire, Your Honor. So she retired in 2013. Back in 2013, they decided that they had enough money that she didn't need to work anymore. She was earning $400,000-plus as a litigator and a partner at a law firm in downtown Minneapolis, and they decided they didn't need her income. So she retired to pursue a political career. She did begin working during the pendency of this proceeding as an attorney again, briefly, and left employment in 2018 and never returned. To say that the market, I mean,
well,
the market.
Hence the maintenance.
Yeah,
and,
yes.
And I mean, we don't, you know, the maintenance ends in 5 years, but whether she will or be able to get a job, I mean, who knows? The expectation is she will, based on the court's findings. But I guess my general position was just, whatever the money they have now, you know, I don't know what's going to happen 5 years from now.
That's true, Your Honor, but the determination of maintenance needs to be determined on reasonable needs known now rather than speculative needs. And right now, including the accumulation of additional assets, when there's no proof, and it was her burden of proof to prove her need, it's inappropriate to award, whether it's savings, whether it's additional retirement, it is not a reasonable need. And I think the case law.
But it is the was the marital standard of living, right? I mean, during the marriage, there was significant monthly contributions to either retirement accounts or taxable brokerage accounts for retirement purposes, and that this is probably less than half of what was typically done. Maybe not. I shouldn't say that. I think that the finding was that they set aside $3,500 a month, and that seems.
They did, although the court's budget for husband does not allow him to accept that. So he has a budget of $4,130, which does not include retirement savings or any kind of savings, and her budget is $10,981. So the court is giving her a budget of $6,800 more than him a month. And while they did invest during the marriage, I would say that that is classic accumulation of assets and the duty to accumulate assets for a spouse post-divorce.
I got to tell you, speaking for myself, that our court in a published opinion recently reversed a case called Schmidt. We reversed with a record very similar to this. We reversed where the district court did not add such an amount to a party's reasonable monthly expenses, and I feel like the Schmidt case is very strong authority for affirming on that issue. That's speaking for myself, but.
And, Your Honor, I'm not familiar with the facts, so I can't analyze that case for you, but I will say the Minnesota Supreme Court decisions on point, like in CEFCOW, indicate that where savings was the only shortfall in that spouse's budget, it was reversed and savings were not considered a reasonable need. I think retirement assets are pertinent as a need at the time of retirement, at the time when the parties are going to enter into retirement, and there shouldn't be an obligation for respondent to continue to fund a retirement account for her. he wouldn't be required to share in increasing retirement assets of his own, so he shouldn't be required to create an account for her. And I think if we look really closely at how the case law originated, the first case that has savings in it separately, another type of asset accumulation, is CONF. And in CONF, it's really a just mischaracterization of what the account was used for. In CONF, it's clear that the dependent spouse in that case used those sums for orthodontics and unreimbursed medical expenses. And that's the first case that allowed this savings. In retirement, that has been accepted when it's done through payroll deductions or when it's seen as, you know, part of the income stream being deducted. But here, when there's just an outright obligation to fund accumulation of assets, it violates our date of valuation and all sorts of other family law concepts in general. And notably, the husband is not allowed in his budget a sum for the same. And I see I'm running low on time.
Can I turn your attention to a different issue?
Yeah.
Thinking of investment income, I want to have a question about your issue you raised about annual investment income for the wife.
As
I read the record, and you're closer to this than I am, your client's expert at trial, totaling seven accounts, I think it was, said the investment the total of that for investment income purposes was like a little under $700,000. Mm-hmm. Yet on appeal, you're talking about a number of $772,000. I mean, so how do you explain that difference?
Right. Both experts used estimates about how many assets would be available to invest, and the number in the appeal is actually taking the trial court's awards of property. And because both experts use the same interest rate and estimates about what would be available. And we're saying, here's what the trial court knew it was awarding to each party. The interest rate was uncontested. So when you apply that, that's the sum.
It's very close from what the trial court provided at trial.
Yes.
And your client's experts.
Yes.
Okay.
And then lastly, in the few seconds remaining, when it comes to budgetary items, there are a few examples where the court creates its own number for the budget. And while there is case law and precedent supporting a court to decrease someone's budget to fit within income, it is not appropriate for the court to just create its own budgetary amount higher than the evidence suggests. Thank you. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Beer.
Thank you.
Ms. Kuhl, you'll have the last word, please.
Thank you. I think I'll start with maintenance. Husband takes issue with a number of the budgetary items that the trial court found, and I would just point out again that obviously these are reviewed for clear error, and the trial court made findings considering, you know, not only the five-year average that husband points to so much, but also other evidence in the record, including husband's budget for himself, which often exceeded the five-year average, wife's testimony, and the budget she submitted with her expert report. And none of these findings rise to the level of clearly erroneous.
Could I ask about the $2,000 for a lease without any evidence that she ever paid that sum to her mother, and with in combination with evidence that she owned two other homes? That's a little bit surprising to me. I mean, why is that within the standard of review?
So the lease was in the record, and the standard of living included
anybody and their mother can draw up a lease. The question is, was money paid to her mother on a monthly basis, and will it be for the next 5 years?
Well, it will be, because the marital home is still under construction. She's not able to live there. Her medical providers suggested that she live in another place because for her mental health. And the standard of living, again, includes having multiple homes. So with all of that evidence and the evidence testimony from her brother that she was living there, the trial court is within its discretion to make the finding that that was a reasonable expense that she incurred.
Can you tell me more about the home under construction? That, I guess that wasn't so prominent in the briefs, but
the marital home was severely water damaged and has been, my understanding is basically unlivable for much of these proceedings. And so that is another reason why she, although she has been living elsewhere. And so...
And with another, often living with another friend, right?
She does occasionally stay with her friends as well, yes.
I mean, it sounds like regularly, more than occasionally. Is that right? I mean, wasn't the testimony from her friend that she was often there, you know, every month throughout the litigation?
She spent some substantial time with her friends.
I also have a question about her car expense. I mean, is it, would you agree that, I mean, the assertion from the opposing counsel is that during the marriage, parties always paid cash for their vehicles, and she, just a few days before trial, purchased a car on, financed the purchase of a car, thereby creating a $500 per month expense. And then I think the payment period is sort of a 5-year period that matches the maintenance period. It just seems like she basically created an expense that you know, can be inserted into her monthly budget, whereas during the marriage they would just immediately transfer cash to vehicles. But why should that be included if there's not a similar amount in the husband's budget?
Wife testified about this. She explained to the trial court that although it's true during the marriage they usually paid cash for their cars, she was not able to do that under the circumstances because she had not had the ability to save up the funds to do so. And the trial court was within its discretion to credit that testimony and make the finding that it was a reasonable expense to buy the same car that she was replacing. It was 13 years old at the time, and she bought a used car. It's not like she went and bought the best car she could find. It was a reasonable replacement for the vehicle that she had.
I guess the question is whether it should be a monthly expense or whether it should be considered, you know, a cash purchase.
And that, I would assert, is within the trial court's discretion. With all of those numbers, if you add them up, it equals $11,140 to meet her reasonable expenses of, she has $11,140 in income to meet expenses of $10,981. That's in excess of $150 a month. So basically, she has income that equals her expenses, and any excess we would assert is de minimis. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted. Since our second case has been canceled, we now are adjourned.
All rise.